Signor, vi perdono, ma non vi cerco capo, a un divino peccato più sparisco le più cittadini. It's my great pleasure to open this session of the Acceptance Scholars Trust for Jewish Education of the College of Jewish Studies for the Jewish Education. Now, we're looking forward to welcome you, and I'm glad to see such a nice turnout. I understand we will be short in seats soon, but we will add seats from the other one if necessary. I just want you to know that our graduate is teaching at the College of Jewish Studies a weekly class in the Book of Psalms, beginning. And you may want to look into it. We have many other programs, Hebrew language, as well as a graduate program for teachers, and courses in Judaica. So if you are interested, please get in touch with us. And now, this lecture is special. Although I must say that every lecture of Rabbi Breitowitz is special. But this is special of specials because this lecture is co-sponsored by the students of the College of Jewish Studies, in memory of Rabbi Breitowitz's father, Mr. David Breitowitz, and I'm sure Rabbi Breitowitz will say more about it. And I just want to make this point. There's no better way in Jewish tradition to remember a loved one or honor a good friend with a public study, with a public session of studying Torah with a great scholar. In this case, tonight, we have a session with led by the son of Mr. David Breitowitz, blessed memory. So it's a great privilege. So if you'd like to dedicate a lecture, please do let us know. And this evening is an example of a current and relevant issue, such as we sponsor from time to time, and the relevance of Judaism to my friends and ultimate question is being demonstrated in these sessions of our Bible. Announcement, if you do record the session, please do it in your seat so we don't have people coming back and changing the pen in front of everybody here. Now, I'd like to thank Charles to Speak Jewish Day School for making these beautiful facilities available to us. And I would also like to thank the committee of volunteers who helped with registration. I know Shelly Rowling was helping with the publicity, Dr. Emmanuel Stava was helping with the registration. Now, at the conclusion of this session, you will have an opportunity to ask questions, and you know that the Rabbi Breitowitz always welcomes questions. Now, just one more word. I believe that it is not necessary. Unnecessary for me to introduce Rabbi Breitowitz to this audience. However, instead of introducing Rabbi Breitowitz and telling you when that is in Greece and so on, which is the usual thing to do, I want to draw your attention to the fact that Rabbi Breitowitz draws for his lectures and classes people from all walks of life, from all ideological groups, Reform, Orthodox, Conservative, Constructionist, Zionist, non-Zionist, whatever you like. He brings together the Jewish community through the study of Jewish texts and values. And I really had a problem in my mind, how one that would be so successful in doing such a great thing, to bring together a Jewish community to study together, to study Turks and Arabs. And I do attend as many classes of Rabbi Baikovich as I can afford to spend time. So I was in one of the classes, and so was a pleasure, really an intellectual and spiritual experience, in which Rabbi Baikovich was discussing two mitzvot he mentioned. One was the mitzvah of writing your own Torah. The last mitzvah in the Torah, if I remember about it correctly, so okay. Now the last mitzvah in the Torah is to write your Torah. And you never think about it, but how many people are fulfilling the mitzvah of writing the Torah? There are ways of getting around this, to have time for it, but really to do the ritual straightforward, very difficult, are doing it. And one is for the course of next one is called a tale, which is an ancient law in the Torah. It was done in the 1,000 years ago, when the Torah was read to the entire Jewish community every 7 years. So, and I must add the fulfillment of this book of the previous list of writing on Torah, you have to write it. You spend the meaning inherited. If you do inherit, you have to spiritualize your own. And these two mitzvahs are the next two mitzvahs. So, Rabbi Baikovich says that the importance of that these two mitzvahs, the proximity of these two mitzvahs, being next to each other, shows one thing, the importance to be a part of the Jewish community, which is the mitzvah of Hakeya, which is every 7 years to the entire Jewish community. However, at the same time, you have to write your own story. Individual. So it's emphasized that one is not to limit in like an ingredient in a challenge. Yes, there was Shabbat, so you know what the challenge is, but rather but it came this individuality, not in the South. That's the general view. And of course, the learning of living Jewishly, rather than a each person has to have his own approach, has to work on it pretty hard, and work out his own approach to live and learn in Jewishly. It's not easy. It's a lifelong mitzvah, I think. So, in a symbolic way, these two mitzvahs are very important. Now I understand better how Rabbi Baikovich gets everybody together to study, because he respects and he emphasizes that each person in his group has to remain an individual and has to follow his own opinion and has to attain his own conclusion. And I was writing his guidance for free with fresh information. And I think this is why we are able to study with Rabbi Baikovich and gather about that. So, without any further ado, it is my great pleasure to introduce them to talk to Rabbi Baikovich, who I call my reference. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Hoffman, for those kind remarks. First, I do want to express my deep gratitude to the people who sponsored tonight's lecture in memory of my father, Olav HaShalom. As most of you know, I did lose my father this past summer, and I'm in the middle of saying Kaddish. As all parents are, he got a lot of nachas when he was able to hear his son do something, and I hope that in the Olam HaEmetz, he is getting a lot of nachas tonight. This is not the occasion where I want to give a full appreciation of my father. I just want to say that he had many, many midos that I could only hope to emulate. every single person that he met. So as Pirkei Avos says, he was always makabel b'sever panim yafos. He had a very, very pleasant manner. And people really loved him. You know, people who wouldn't talk to me in my own shul always made sure to talk to my dad when he came. So that was a very, very, very special. He and my mother, may she be well, were married for 62 years, and they knew each other for 67 years, 5 years before that. And they escaped from Poland in 1939, and they spent 5 years in Siberia. They thought they had it bad. When they came back, it turned out they had it good, at least in a relative sense. It was not the same as the concentration camps. And together, they a number of times they had to risk their lives for each other, various scary scenarios in Russia, and then they came to the United States and built a life together. So once again, I think all of us know how much all of our accomplishments were really standing on the shoulders of our predecessors, of our parents. And everything we do is only because of what they gave us. And therefore, we owe them to live our lives in accordance with their ideals. So I hope that this should be an Ilei Neshama. The topic of Judaism and the environment is not a particularly apropos topic for tonight, but I'm thinking that tonight actually is Yom HaAtzmaut. Of course, because of the Israeli chief rabbinate's ruling, the festivities are going to be observed tomorrow night. But tonight and tomorrow are the fifth day of Iyar. And as you know, environmental issues are quite hot in Israel. One of the things that Americans sometimes notice in Eretz Israel is that unfortunately environmental consciousness is not as great as it might be in the United States. And it's still disheartening when one sees the streets of Yerushalayim sometimes strewn with garbage. But one should know that every time you bend over and you pick up a paper cup or a candy wrapper and you put it in the garbage in Eretz Yisrael, you are fulfilling an aspect of the mitzvah of settling Eretz Yisrael, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which Nachmanides says includes beautifying the land. So in a sense, talking about the environment, I think, is very relevant for tonight. Let me start off with a story that I've mentioned before. The story is told about an obsessive-compulsive individual who always had to be fully prepared for whatever challenge he faced. And upon his retirement, he was taking his first trip to Israel. But he was told that in those days, it would be a seven-hour stopover in Paris. So he spent the year before the trip studying French so that he would be totally prepared for the stopover. At the end of the year, he spoke French very well. He ordered in Charles de Gaulle Airport, he ordered a Coke like a native. And he was very proud of himself until he realized after 7 hours that he was so busy getting prepared for the stopover, he didn't bother to learn Hebrew, which was his ultimate destination. Now, this is actually a mashal for what life is about. You know, we do have an ultimate destination after 120 years, and that's to give an accounting of ourselves to God. And the only thing that matters at the very end of everything is the goodness and the mitzvot and the service of Hashem that we did. It is true that in this stopover, which we hope will be for 120 years, there are many, many skills that we have to master. But if one gets so obsessed with the stopover skills and one neglects the permanent skill that one needs, then one is being very short-sighted in a way that is indeed much more tragic than the person who simply didn't bother to learn Hebrew. And therefore, it's very, very good that on a Sunday evening, when there's so much other activities for people to do, that they do desire to come to learn Torah, to study Torah, to think about things that have eternal value and not merely ephemeral or transient, because ultimately, that's really what's going to count in our lives and in the lives of our children. One of the striking phenomena of modern urbanized life, and Jews, by and large, are an urbanized people, at least by historical circumstance, is how distant we are from the grandeur and beauty of nature. In the ancient worlds, people were exquisitely sensitive to the cycles of the sun and the moon and the stars and the planets. Certainly the Jewish people were, even the pilgrimage festivals. You can see this difference. When we talk about Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, so we think about Pesach, is the holiday of the Exodus, of course, and Shavuos is the holiday of getting the Torah, and Sukkot is the holiday that commemorates the clouds of glory, and all of that is, of course, true. But if you look in the Chumash itself, The Chumash itself relates each of the pilgrimage festivals to part of the cycle of agriculture. Pesach is the springtime ripening of the barley at the very beginning of the grain ripening process. And Shavuos, during those 50 days, the other crops ripen, and by Shavuos you're ready to harvest the wheat. And then Sukkos, after the fruits have remained in the field for the long hot summer till the moisture has been dried out, the fruits are brought home. And the ancient Israelite, the Jew who observed the Torah and was in the rhythms of the Torah, appreciated the cycle of earth. Rosh Chodesh, the Jewish calendar, is based on observations of the moon. The pilgrimage festivals are based on cycles of agriculture. Even things that we don't normally associate with environmental consciousness, on one level, represent a very great sensitivity to the environment. Let me give you an example that is not so obvious. We know that in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, and in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, on the north side of the tabernacle was the golden table in which there were 12 loaves of bread, the Lechem HaPanim, and on the south side of the tabernacle was the menorah that was lit with olive oil. And the Talmud tells us that the Shulchan of Lechem HaPanim is where you turn to for parnasa, the blessings of material sustenance, because bread represents material sustenance. The light of the menorah represents wisdom, and therefore the Talmud actually makes the comment, if you want to get wealthy, you should pray towards the north, and if you want to have wisdom, you should pray towards the south. Okay, so one should remember this. Although every synagogue should be facing Yerushalayim, which is to our east, but if you're facing Jerusalem and you want money, you should daven northeast. If you're facing Jerusalem and you want wisdom, you should daven southeast. This is what the Gemara says. But why is it that the north is designated as the direction of Parnassa and the south is the direction of the menorah? Obviously, there are mystical reasons, but some have suggested this also corresponds to the agricultural cycle. The north wind in Eretz Yisrael is the wind that brings the rain. And wheat and grain need quite a lot of moisture to be able to grow. So when we ask God for a blessing for the grain, we turn towards the north because we want the north wind. Olive trees, the oil of the menorah, olives need a lot of dry heat. So for olives, they benefit from the south wind, the winds that bring the chamsin, the winds that bring the hot weather. So consequently, we turn to the north for rain, and we turn to the south for heat. And that's the combination. Even the Shiva Taminim, people ask the question, all of us know that the land of Israel is praised for the seven species. And the seven species are Chitim, Usaora, wheat and barley, Gepen, our grapes, the grapes of the vine, Teina, our figs, Rimon, our pomegranate, and Zayt Shemen is the olive oil, and Davash, honey, we know our interpretation of honey is date honey, which is very, very sweet indeed, very delicious. You should try date honey rather than bee honey. And these are the seven minim shenishtabchu ba Yisrael that the Eretz Yisrael is praised with. Now people ask the question, it is a good question, that these are not necessarily the best fruits that Eretz Yisrael has. If you remember at the end of Genesis, when Yaakov picks choice gifts to send to, yes, we don't know what to send Yosef, but to the Mishnah Lamelech, the second in command in Egypt, he picks Zimrat Haaretz, the song, the beautiful music of the land. They are not the Shiva Taminim. So the Shiva Taminim are not necessarily the most beautiful fruits. But if one understands the agricultural cycle, which we don't, and I didn't until I read this, one can see a special significance in the Shiva Taminim. And it was pointed out by the director of Neot Kedumim, which is a wonderful nature preserve in Eretz Yisrael, that the Shiva Taminim require contradictory climatic conditions. That what is good for some are specifically not good for the other. Some thrive in moisture, some thrive in heat, some need wind, some need sun. And consequently, that's why the Canaanites were so paganistic. Because they thought there were different gods that can handle different things. But God wants us to realize that the rain and the sun and the moon and the cold and the hot all come from one source.
So consequently, we worship God by taking the seven species, each of which needs a different type of climate, to recognize that it all comes from one God. So there was a tremendous sensitivity. I remember myself, you look up at the stars. God tells Abraham, look up at the stars and see how many your children will be. Well, we look up at the stars and we can count 15 stars. Doesn't sound so much. But I remember when I was in Eretz Yisrael, and I was up in Amuka. Amuka is near Tzfat. And as the name suggests, Amuka is a very deep, deep valley. Hard to get to. And there's a grave there, a grave of a great rabbi in the Mishnah, Yonah ben Uziel, who was a disciple of Hillel. And there's an old tradition that if one needs to get married, one should go pray at the grave of Yonah ben Uziel. And we always have these stories about the young lady who happened to leave her sitter there. And the young man found the sitter with the address and called up to return it, and different things happened. I'm sure leaving the sitter was an accident. There, we were sitting in total darkness. And I look up at the sky, and I see uncountable numbers of stars. And then we understand what it means. But we don't see, we don't look. We think tomatoes comes from giants. And chocolate milk comes from brown cows. Without understanding. The Maharal even tells us that there is a linkage between the physical worlds and the spiritual phenomena. If Pesach is during the spring, as it must be, that shows that just as the land is liberated from the long winter, so too the human being acquires the freedom to be liberated from whatever enslaves. Shavuot, which is Matan Torah, corresponds to the ability of a human to harvest knowledge and insight. The harvesting of the wheat corresponds to the ability to harvest knowledge. If Sukkot is ingathering of the fruits, that corresponds with the ability to integrate our knowledge into our psychological inner life. In other words, what happens physically on earth is a mirror of spiritual realities. And therefore, if one is not sensitive to what is happening in earth, one's neshama is not truly sensitive to the spiritual aura that exists in the world at any one time. Let's take prayers, tefillot. We pray in the morning, we pray in the afternoon, we pray in the evening. For most of us, although it's a different text, so to speak, but the Shemona Esrei is the same, we pray with the same electric light in morning, afternoon, and evening. But if you think about it, in the days before electricity, the notion of praying in these different times of day was designed to awaken different emotional states within a human being. The morning, where I see the light of the sun, inspires me with the prayer of hope and optimism. And the afternoon, where the sun is setting and the day is over, I have fear and trepidation that I must turn to God to protect me as my day is ending. And at night, when it's totally dark and I have no way of protecting myself, I turn to God with faith that even though I am helpless, Hashem will take care of me. You see that the Torah creates a system where all of the natural rhythms of the world give a person inspiration. But we have become dead to it. We're dead to it because we're in Galut, of course. We're not in our own lands. And for hundreds of years, many Jews were not even allowed to own land in Galut countries. And as a result, we've become urbanized. And although city life certainly has its advantages, but it distances us from the vision our connection with nature would be. It's very interesting that the first order of the Mishnah is the order that is called Zeraim, which is agriculture. And that Seder, that order of the Mishnah, has a nickname in the Gemara. And the nickname of the order of Zeraim is Seder Emunah, the order of faith. Of all of the orders of the Mishnah, it is the laws of agriculture that are called faith. And the reason is, Rashi explains, because the farmer above all knows how dependent he is upon God. Because you can have all the skill in the world, if you don't have the right rain, you don't have the right sun, you don't have the right wind, you're going to not be successful. Now, the truth of the matter is, all of us depend on God, whether we're the lawyer, the doctor, or the accountant. But we sometimes, in those other fields, we might have the illusion that that we're in charge. But the farmer knows that they are at the mercy of forces that are much larger than the farmer. And therefore, the farmer lives the life of Emunah, the farmer and the shepherd. And that is why Seder Zeruyim is called the Seder of Emunah. Now, we know that the Mekubalim, the mystics of Tzfat in the 16th century, the students of the Ari, enacted the custom that many people follow. It's mainly among Sephardim, but now it's very popular among Ashkenazim as well, to have the Tu Bishvat Seder, which essentially is our celebration of our connection to nature in the context of a holy expression of gratitude to God. And there's an interesting minhag of the Tu Bishvat Seder in which one has four cups of wine, and the first cup of wine is totally white, and then you add a little red to the second cup, more red to the third cup, and the fourth cup is mainly red. And although there are many interpretations, but one of the interpretations too is that that corresponds with the changing seasons as you move from the winter, because Shvat is a transition between the winter months in Eretz Yisrael and the summer months, and red represents the growth of leaves and vegetation, and you're going from the white gradually. And this could inspire a person in a very, very great way. So, the Judeo-Christian ethic, again, forgive me for using that term, just a common term, although many criticize it, has often been blamed for the attitude that our environment is so polluted and resources are being squandered. And environmentalists, like, I guess Jews get blamed for everything ultimately, so Jews are blamed for the environmental crisis as well. And this is based on Genesis chapter 1. When Adam HaRishon is created, and he's put in the Garden of Eden, Li'abda u'lashamra, the Kipshua, the Turo, be fruitful and multiply, Milu es ha'aretz, fill the land, the Kipshua, conquer it, dominate it, control it, master it. Say the environmentalists, the Jewish ethic, which was then passed on to other Western religions, is one of conquest, domination, and control, instead of living in harmony with nature. And as a result of our abuse of nature, say the environmentalists, we have this crisis that we have today. But the truth of the matter is, as is often the case, when you take psukim out of context, you will have a distorted reading. For example, it says, "Thou shalt not murder." Well, if you take out the word low and you just say, tirtzach, murder, right? You have to read the low. Now, the truth of the matter is, there are two different missions that are given to mankind. One in Genesis chapter 1, and one in Genesis chapter 2. In Genesis chapter 1, the mission that is given to man is kibush. Kibush means control and domination and mastery. Indeed. But in Genesis chapter 2, the mission that is given to mankind is not conquest and domination, but it's li'avda, to work the ground, to serve the ground, u'lashomra, and to preserve it. And thus what the Torah is doing is, the Torah is creating a balance. We're not pagans who worship nature. Certainly mankind is supposed to emulate God and control nature. Judaism rejects what might be called passive quiescence. We fight tornadoes and hurricanes and sicknesses. We don't take the position because it's natural, let it happen. We are supposed to be God's partners in making the world a better and a safer and a more civilized place. Rav Soloveitchik used to point out very often that scientific and technological progress is a fulfillment of this idea of conquering and mastering. So we don't say a tree is as valuable as a human being. But at the same time, our mastery over the world is conditioned with responsibilities for preservation and nurturance. And Rav Soloveitchik called this the mission of Adam 1 versus the mission of Adam 2. It's the same Adam, but these two different perspectives. Adam 1 is the majestic power of man. And Adam 2 is the redemptive power of man, as man realizes his weakness, his subservience.
the fact that he is subordinate to the divine plan and cannot simply take charge of everything. This, by the way, is a very important medical technology issue, such as cloning and the like. This balance between mastering and controlling nature, and at the same time preserving God's world and not trying to mess it up. So, because if one only has Genesis 1, that leads to arrogance, abuse, and irresponsibility. But if one only has Genesis 2, that leads to passivity, quiescence, helplessness, and despair. And the Torah calls upon the human being to embody both of those attributes together, even though they are contradictory. So, I would have to say that the environmental charge against Judaism, that it necessitates an abuse of the environment by virtue of the control and conquest and domination, is simply false when you read it together with Genesis number 2. So, what I want to do tonight, for at least briefly, is to kind of construct a philosophical and ethical understanding of how Judaism views the environment by examining halachot. And this is very, very important. And again, Soloveitchik made this point, and the truth is, for anyone that is conversant with Jewish religious literature, the point is almost obvious. And that is, the philosophy of Judaism does not emerge from philosophical speculation, but it emerges from examining specific halachic rulings. The halacha is the unfolding of God's will. And that will is often not expressed in philosophical generalities. It is expressed in specific and detailed rules. But what you have to do is, you then look at the rules, you connect the dots, and you extrapolate a philosophy of life from halachic rulings. For a logician, we would call that an inductive method of thinking, rather than a deductive. Instead of starting with some general principle, one looks at a lot of specific data, and from that data one extrapolates a value system. And that is why any authentic Jewish value system must be rooted in the minutiae and details of halakhic rulings. To put it another way, a philosophic generalization that is inconsistent with the specific data of halakhic rulings is by definition not a valid statement of a traditional Jewish philosophical understanding. So, by the way, I could just digress for a moment about that. This has actually been a classic criticism of Judaism, starting back from the Apostle Paul, where Paul accused Judaism of being overly legalistic. We have this rule and that rule and that rule and that rule. Why don't we just have some general principles? Love God, be a good person, and act moral. We have to have a whole book, a 300-page book by the Chafetz Chaim, about the laws of gossip. I mean, just say, you know, be a good person. But the truth of the matter is, the halakhic system is predicated on the fact that human beings have an infinite capacity for self-delusion. And if you simply leave it to each and every one of us to simply decide what is good, far too often we will cut corners and do what is expedient and convenient for us. And therefore, the whole halakhic system is based on the fact that we have to have guidance and structure. And even then, there's plenty of gray areas, and even then, we make plenty of mistakes. But at least the margin of error is circumscribed somewhat. So that's really the answer to Paul, because Paul basically said, leave people to their own devices, and the gift of faith will be enough to save them. Judaism says faith is a wonderful thing, if you have it in the right God. But faith is a wonderful thing, but you also need the structure and the guidance of a halakhic system. So let me go over a few halakhic concepts that bear on environmentalist concerns. The first and the most obvious is the verse in Deuteronomy that says that when the Jewish people wage war against their enemies in the land of Canaan, the land of Canaan, they are not allowed to destroy fruit-bearing trees. Because the pasuk says, is the tree a man? Is the tree your enemy that you should attack it? Now the truth of the matter is, the particular context is time of war. But the Gemara and Maimonides follows this ruling, extrapolates from this mitzvah
a general principle, which is referred to as Baal Tashchit. Baal is just a form of the word lo, but the word in the Torah is lo sashchit, do not destroy. That there is a prohibition in the Torah against wanton destruction of property, which could otherwise be put to a productive use. You don't cut down fruit trees because you're destroying their productive potential. You don't rip garments. In fact, the Gemara even has a case. What if I want to rip a garment to express my anger to a child, to give them more discipline or the like? It's not allowed. It is considered to be hashchasa, needless destruction. Occasionally, for mourning, for example, we have a mitzvah to rip a garment. That's ripping kriya. But those are rare cases. So Baal Tashchit is taken as a general imperative not to waste food, not to waste fuel. This could certainly be a halachic basis for responsibilities of recycling and conservation. Again, actual recycling is a bit of a tricky problem. I'm not an environmentalist expert. Sometimes the costs involved in the recycling are great, in which case the Baal Tashchit argument would argue not to recycle, but it depends on the particular program. But in theory, one should try to reuse, one tries not to waste. Right? So Baal Tashchit is certainly a halakhic source that supports the notion of conservation and recycling. That's one halakhic category, Baal Tashchit. There is another halakhic category, which is really not addressed at all in the written Torah, but it's addressed extensively in the oral Torah, in the Talmud. And that is, what are the responsibilities I have in using my property not to cause damage to another person's enjoyment of their property? Those who are attorneys know that under tort law, this would be subsumed under the branch of law that is called the law of private nuisance, meaning what type of uses of my property are disturbing somebody else. And in the Talmud, we have a whole chapter, the second chapter of Masechet Bava Batra, that deals with what are called Niskei Shechenim. Niskei Shechenim are the damages that neighbors inflict on one another. For example, let's assume I enjoy doing jackhammering on weekends. Right? I just enjoy the rhythm and the noise. Am I allowed to do that if that's going to, you know, wake you up and that's going to cause vibration and the like? What are the responsibilities? Essentially, on one hand, I could argue, well, it's my property. Why can't I do what I want on my property? On the other hand, if using my property a certain way affects the ability of you to enjoy your property a certain way, then halacha, as would legal systems in various respects, would normally restrict ownership. Like, what's the saying in law? My right to swing my hand ends where your nose begins. That's a saying. Well, the same thing. My right to use my land, you know, ends when it interferes. So in the Talmud, we have many, many, many specific rulings regarding the responsibility to use your property in a way that does not cause injury or damage to another. There are laws regarding noxious smells, air pollution, to engage in certain activities that cause the air quality to go down. There are rules regarding smoke, vibration, water, and air pollution. Just to give an example, you're not allowed to bathe in drinking water. Again, in the days when there was no indoor plumbing, people might take a bath anywhere. You can't bathe in drinking water. And if you have a contagious disease, you can't even bathe in bathing water because you may give somebody the disease. So we have all sorts of rules. Threshing floors. When you thresh grain, the chaff of grain often makes it difficult to breathe. People inhale and the like. So a threshing floor must be surrounded by a radius of 50 cubits on all sides of empty space, because if it's too close to someone else's property, you're going to be interfering with the air quality and their ability to breathe. So we find that over 2,000 years ago, the Talmud was very sensitive to air pollution, water pollution, vibration, and noise. There are zoning rules in the Talmud. For example, one is not allowed to open businesses in residential neighborhoods that will markedly increase the pedestrian traffic, because that would disturb the quiet and the peace of a neighborhood. The exception to that, by the way, is opening up a school for the teaching of Torah is always allowed, because that's only considered a blessing. Right? The Jewish school, is a good thing because more Torah will be learned. But in terms of businesses, there was a notion of the respect for the quiet enjoyment of property. So we see that one way of approaching environmental issues is not so much my loyalty to the environment, but as a simple interpersonal issue in which each person, each company, each business has a responsibility not to do, engage in activities that result in the lowering of the quality of life of other people. By the way, in the environmental movement, this is called low ecology as opposed to high ecology. In other words, low ecology simply says, don't pollute the environment because you're hurting other people. High ecology says that's racist or speciesism because you're still elevating, that's still, in other words, abusive because you're still elevating people. The real thing is don't hurt the environment. Well, Judaism, at least from one perspective, is ultimately concerned more with people than the environment in the abstract. But the duty not to harm others would indicate a certain respect for environment. Let me mention another halakhic example, which is very intriguing because it is normally not understood as an environmental regulation, but Rav Shimshon and Val Hirsch in the 19th century says it is. You know that the Levites, the Levian, were given 48 cities in the land of Israel. They were scattered through all the tribes. And there is a halakha that every Levite city must be surrounded with a radius of 2,000 cubits or a square of vacant lands, 1,000 of which was green parklands, and 1,000 of which were fields. And the halakha is that the city could not expand into those parklands. Now, this is not a general rule. This only applied to the Orei Levian, and this is called a migrash. But Rapersh suggests that the Torah is intimating the ideal type of urban environment that we should have. You know, one of the issues is called urban sprawl, where things kept on being built and built and built. Here, what the Torah is basically saying is, a city should remain small. It can't really expand. You can build another city, but cities don't expand beyond those initial boundaries. It is surrounded by greenery, which must be permanently dedicated and never encroached. And it creates a small, intimate urban environment which is self-contained and doesn't keep on growing. Now, many city planners will tell you that that's actually the wave of the future in constructing even within cities, little cities within cities or villages within larger cities in which these are self-contained units. And Rapersh says that the Midrash is the prototype for the ideal type of urban environment that one should strive for, in which there is a connection to grass and to greenery and to trees, and the community remains small and intimate and does not expand beyond those boundaries. As I indicated, tonight is the 5th of Iyar, so there are many special enactments in the Talmud, particularly to enhance the beauty of Eretz Yisrael. I'll give you an interesting example. Let's assume that I have olive trees on my property, and a river comes and sweeps away the olive trees and plants them downstream on your property. So I'm coming along and I'd like to have my olive trees back. The halakha is I don't get my olive trees back. Rather, the landowner downstream pays me and I buy other trees and plant them on my property. And the reason is, in order to enhance the fertility of the land of Israel, the more trees the better. So instead of you getting your trees back, and that person probably not planting a tree because he didn't have a tree before, we say, let him keep the tree, he'll pay you, and then you get other trees to enhance the beauty and the fertility of the land of Israel. There are laws that say one is not allowed to raise sheep and goats in areas in which fields grow, because sheep and goats are actually very destructive. One of the terms, sheep and goats are actually called woolly locusts, because they do consume all the vegetation, and in order to preserve the fertility of the land of Israel, the sheep and the goat, although today obviously it's not that followed, but according to the Talmud's ruling, should be relocated to isolated desert areas. 2,000 years ago, there was daily garbage removal in Yerushalayim. So I think we've gone downhill since then. The halakha is, you're not allowed to have pottery kilns or furnaces in Yerushalayim because of smoke pollution. And the holy city in particular has to be used, because that is a glory to God. As I indicated, when you pick up trash in the land of Israel, you are fulfilling the mitzvah of making the land of Israel a little bit more beautiful. And the Ramban actually says that that is something that is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Israel, living in the land of Israel. So Chazal, our sages, had a great sensitivity for the importance of a beautiful environment. An environment in which there are things that are growing, an environment of good air, of good water, not because Chazal were pagan in orientation, but Chazal understood that physical beauty can often awaken within our souls spiritual sensitivities. And Chazal say that a bayit na'eh, a beautiful home, for example, marchiven dato shaladam, give a person an expansiveness of mind. So these are different situations that Chazal pointed out in which we are concerned for our environment. Let me mention yet another halakhic source. You see, you look at various sources and then a picture emerges. There are laws that one is not allowed to put themselves in a dangerous situation. How do we know that? The Torah says, if you have a roof, this means a flat roof, you are obligated to build a fence around your flat roof, lest somebody go on the roof and fall off. You're not allowed to maintain dangerous instrumentalities in your property. And this applies to many, many things. You're not allowed to endanger yourself or others. Jews are not allowed to do bungee jumping or dangerous activities. And certainly, a lot of the environmental risks that people face are not just risks of aesthetics, but they are risks that pertain to health. There's carcinogenic effects, there's long-term effects on health and on welfare and on life, and many of these activities would be prohibited because they generate what is called sakana. They generate what is called danger. However, I have to say that of all of the halakhic constructs, this is actually the most difficult to pin down. In other words, certainly one could not make a blanket statement, you can't pollute the air because it's dangerous. And let me explain why it is a difficult, subtle idea to condemn. The notion that halakhically you're not allowed to do dangerous things can certainly not be taken totally literally. I assume that most of the people here probably drove. Driving is a dangerous activity. Statistically, it is a dangerous activity. Walking is also a dangerous activity. The point is, obviously, the halakha does not prohibit doing anything that carries with it any risk of danger, because there is no such thing that doesn't carry within it some risk of danger. Rather, halakha permits what are called reasonable risks. Halakha prohibits what are called unreasonable risks. Now that, of course, begs the question, what makes a risk reasonable and what makes a risk unreasonable? And here we have a teaching in the Gemara, which is a bit enigmatic. The Talmud lays down a rule that any risks that average people commonly accept as part of ordinary life, we apply the verse, Shomer Ketayim Hashem, God protects the foolish. So, for example, cigarettes smoking is actually a good example. 30, 40, 50 years ago, maybe before that, when the dangers of cigarette smoking were not widely known. So then we say, you know, this was, in fact, if you go back to some old advertisements, I remember seeing old cigarette advertisements in the 30s, in which they promoted smoking as beneficial to health. That was actually it. It helps your digestion, it clears the sinuses. In fact, they had a thing about smoking is good for you. It aids digestion. So even if some people were aware of risks, but if that was a risk that society accepted as legitimate, halakha permitted you to do it. Today, when the dangers of smoking are much more widely known, There are opinions, there are halachic opinions that say a Jew is not allowed to smoke. Now, I want to say there are opinions. The great Rav Moshe Feinstein was not willing to prohibit it, but there are opinions. So the point is, what could be in one point of historical understanding a reasonable risk can turn into an unreasonable risk afterwards. But even here, we have a problem of statistics. Mark Twain once remarked, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And that is, statistics can be very misleading. Let's take smoking for example. I'm not going to give you the actual numbers, I don't have them. But if we say, for example, that, well, just take an activity in the abstract, that without a certain risk factor, 1 out of 100,000 people will get a certain illness. And with the risk factor, 1 out of 10,000 people will get that illness. Now, there are two ways you can look at that. You could say, this is an unreasonable risk, because it increases the magnitude of danger 10 times. Right? You're making it 10 times more likely. But you see, another way of looking at it is, 1 out of 10 isn't so bad. So when you analyze these public health issues, statistics can often be described in different ways. You can describe something in terms of a magnitude of risk, which makes it sound real, real bad. But even with a high magnitude of risk, it might still be a relatively small chance. So these are difficult halachic judgments. Certainly, halacha does permit dangerous activities to be engaged in if they are reasonable risks and there's a long-term benefit for society, but each program would have to be evaluated separately. Riding the bus, you know, unfortunately, Rahman al-Islam, we know that in Israel, in particular, we have the tragedies of the homicide bombers, the suicide bombers, however you call them. Someone pointed out that you could call homicide bombers because they are murderers. Of course, on a more lighter note, even in good times, riding a bus in Israel was always somewhat dangerous because of the way the bus drivers drove. They tell a story, it's a classic story, about a great rabbi and an Eged bus driver died the same day, and they came to heaven, and the Eged bus driver got in right away while the rabbi had to wait. And of course the rabbi got in, but eventually the rabbi says, you know, I've been learning Torah my whole life, I've been doing mitzvahs my whole life, and I wait, and he gets in before me. So the angel in charge said, well, how much Tehillim did you get people to say? You know. But just to give you an example of how complicated this is, let's imagine, I'm making up numbers because I don't really have statistics here. Let's imagine we have a pesticide that has a 1 in 1,000,000 risk of fetal cancer, or 1 in 10,000 risk. But by use of the pesticide, a crop yield will be increased by 25%. And feed another 1,000 people who might otherwise die. So on one hand, doing this will result in some deaths, but it might result in more lives being saved. It's a very complicated issue. In fact, in environmental law and policy, this is really one of the most complicated issues of risk assessment, and the point is, a pure halakhic analysis would require this type of risk assessment. Of course, as the saying goes, 1 in 1,000,000 chance, you know, if your child is the 1 out of 1,000,000, statistics don't matter very much. But still, when we build a bridge, we know ahead of time a certain number of workers are going to be killed in the construction. We know that. So we constantly engage in activities for the benefit of society that result in some possibility of death. Nevertheless, it is certainly clear as a general principle, considerations of not recklessly endangering other people is a halachic value that must be considered in environmental analysis. Let me mention two more halachic points. One is the law that is called Tsar Balei Chayim, not causing needless pain to animals. This is considered to be a Torah law, not to cause unnecessary suffering or pain even to animals. There's a very interesting ruling of the Ramah, Rav Moshe Israelis. We know that when people buy new articles of clothing, they make a Shechiyanu blessing, thanking God for a wonderful new suit or something. Actually, Rav Soloveitchik said that that was more in Europe, where people got a suit, you know, every 10 years. Today, he suggested it's more common. But be it as it may, the Ramah rules in the Shulchan Aruch that if one buys new shoes, you don't say a Shechiyanu. because shoes are obtained, unlike wool and cotton, shoes are obtained only by killing animals. And although it is permitted to kill animals, the Ramah is not saying you can't kill animals, but one does not rejoice, one does not have a simcha in the fact that a life was taken. We don't make a shaviyani. For example, there's a famous responsa of the great Nodab Yehuda, the great rabbi of Prague, Rabbi Yecheskel Landau, in the 18th century, where he has a very long tshuva that a Jew could never be a recreational hunter. If you're killing to eat, that's one thing. Of course, in general hunting, you're not going to be able to check it, right? The bullet is not going to do a proper shechita. But if you're just hunting for recreation or fun, he says that is cruelty, and that is not something that Judaism countenances because of the pain that one causes to Baal HaChaim. Now, you know there's a bit of a controversy, there's always been a controversy, about the institution of shechita, particularly in Europe. Anti-Semitic accusations are raised that the Jewish law of ritual slaughter involves cruelty to animals. In point of fact, the actual process, in fact, one of Hitler's first decrees was to ban shechita on humanitarian grounds. Of course, we know what wonderful humanitarian he was. And of course, Hitler was a vegetarian as well. However, studies have shown that shechita itself, the slitting of the neck, the slitting of the esophagus, trachea, and the jugular arteries, is a very painless way of slaughter. The animal loses consciousness almost immediately. A shechita, as death's go, is a fairly humanitarian way of slaughter. That is not to say, however, that there are not other abuses in meat processing, including kosher meat processing, that can be condemned as violative of Tzar Baal HaChaim. For example, the penning of veal, in which calves are not allowed to move around, the force feeding, in which the animals are stuffed until they're almost unconscious, even the hoisting of the animals upside down to be able to slaughter them easily, there are problems. I am not at all suggesting that all kosher is equally kosher in that sense. But the shechita itself is humane, although the things that slaughterhouses might do, and this is Jewish and not Jewish, might involve cruelty to animals, and that would be condemned. And this being, I just want to address two issues once we talk about Tzar Baal HaChaim. First, let me tell you a story involving the author of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the great Rabbi Judah the Prince. The story goes, he was once walking in the streets, and a calf ran to him and stuck its head, calf was being led to slaughter, and stuck its head under his coat for protection. And he pushed away the calf and he said, "Go! This is your destiny. This is what you were created for." It is said that because he showed cruelty to animals, he was smitten with an illness for 13 years in which he suffered. He didn't know that was the reason necessarily. And this was like, these were excruciating pain. And the illness did not go away till 13 years later, his servant was cleaning out the house and she came across a nest of field mice. And she wanted to sweep it out. And he said, "Let it alone. For Rachamav al kol masav, God's compassion is on all of his creatures." And the moment he said that, he got better. His sin was lack of compassion for the animal. As soon as he showed that compassion, it got better. But let me raise two issues regarding Tzar Baal HaChaim. First of all, let me raise the issue of vegetarianism. Does halacha, well, I guess it certainly doesn't require it, but does halacha suggest that vegetarianism is a better way to go? That's one issue I want to address briefly. Really can have a talk of its own. And the second issue is the use of animals in laboratory testing of various situations. We know, of course, we have organizations like PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, which is actually a quite violent organization. You know, you think PETA, these are nice people that pet dogs and, you know, everything else. And these are people that blow up buildings and kill human beings. And they were very condemnatory of the suicide bombing when a donkey was blown up. But they didn't issue any statements regarding all the people that were killed.
So PETA is a very dangerous organization. But nevertheless, their ethical position is that it is immoral to eat meat because that causes pain and suffering to animals. Well, here is the thing. One thing I think we could say very, very clearly. If one takes the position and is immoral, as immoral, a practice which the Torah says you're allowed to do. Now, it's true that before the flood, mankind did live on a vegetarian diet, and there are some statements in Rav Kook's writings that in the days of the Mashiach, we will revert once again to that type of vegetarian diet. By the way, contrary to rumor, Rav Kook was not a vegetarian, but Rav Kook did talk about vegetarianism as a progression in human sensitivity. But Rav Kook makes the following argument, which is very interesting. He says, there is a natural progression in ethical sensitivities. Meaning, as you become more sensitive to human beings, you then expand your consciousness and you embrace animals and the like. But to jump to the animal and skip the human being results in a distortion of priorities, in which one might elevate the animal to be even higher than a human being. A very good example of this perverse thinking is Peter Singer. Peter Singer, brilliant Jewish man from Australia, who's now a professor in Princeton, is one of the well-known medalists of the time. And Peter Singer is famous for two things. Peter Singer is the spiritual father of animal liberation, in which he wrote in the 1960s, works that talked about the fact that animals have rights and people are no better than animals, and for human beings to think that they have the right to dominate the animal kingdom is a form of racism, which he called speciesism. Who says humans are better? And that was his position, and he was really the spiritual mentor of PETA. The second point Peter Singer developed much later was that defective children, newborns, who are not capable of cognition, don't deserve to live in the world, and they are consuming more resources than they are using up, and there is actually a moral obligation to get rid of them. He also applied this analysis to people at the end of life, who are consuming more of the earth's resources than they are contributing. So you see, as Chazal said, he who shows mercy where it is misplaced will ultimately show cruelty. We need to say, equating people to animals does not always result in animals being elevated, but it may result in people being denigrated. By the way, an interesting point about this, Peter Singer made the argument as well that there is no moral validity in favoring your family over anybody else. I mean, if you have $1 million,
and your child is ill, you have no right to use your $1 million for your child. Rather, you should divide it among 1,000 people in Africa. So the interesting issue was, again, not that I take any pleasure in this, but Peter Singer's mother developed Alzheimer's. She was an attorney in Australia. And he put her in a very good hospital with good medical treatments. And he was asked, isn't this inconsistent with your philosophy that resources shouldn't be spent on people who don't have a significant contribution to the world? And Peter Singer remarked, when it's your own mother, philosophy doesn't work so well. So one of the criticisms of Peter Singer is simply that his abstract theorizing does not correspond with the realities of human existence. And the Torah, which does say we have a moral right to help our families, is consistent with human realities and the like. So it would appear that to condemn the eating of meat on the grounds that it's inhumane because of shechit, it's wrong to kill animals, that I think would be incorrect. On the other hand, if you want to be a vegetarian because you want to protest the inhumane way animals are treated before they're slaughtered, that would be interesting because that is within the purview of Tsar Balei Chaim. And certainly if one wanted to be a vegetarian for health reasons, that would also be a legitimate goal. But again, one has to discuss the halachic issues of Shabbat and Yom Tov and the like, which is another issue. The point I'm making is simply this. One is hard-pressed to declare as immoral that which the Torah says is moral. However, that which the Torah says is immoral, I can certainly adopt a strict stance. Hurting animals is immoral, so if I don't want to eat veal because of the way veal is mistreated, that is a halakhically valid stance. Killing animals for human consumption is a permitted activity, and as a result, I really cannot make a moral judgment about that. Of course, if animals are trapped in painful ways or whatever, that's certainly Tsar Balei Chaim, and all of that would be totally prohibited. Fur, boycotting fur. I'm not suggesting it's a halakhic imperative, but at least in the olden days, maybe the trapping is more humane today. But, you know, mink and the other furry animals are trapped in these traps that are so painful that they sometimes chew their legs off to get out of the trap. If one says, I don't want to support a business that hurts animals in that way, that is a respectable moral judgment that one can make. So that's just a little bit about vegetarianism, just a little bit. Again, this deserves a talk of its own. Let me just mention animal testing. Now, animal testing can often be painful. Drugs, chemicals, perfumes, deodorants are put into their eyes or whatever it is. Animals can be blinded. There are federal rules that indeed try to protect animals to a certain degree. But there's no question that animal testing can often cause pain. What does the halakha say about this? So again, here is where we diverge from the animal liberation movements. We do not look at Tsar Balei Chaim as a right that an animal has to be free of pain. Tsar Balei Chaim is a responsibility that human beings have not to cause unnecessary suffering to animals. So it all depends on why the suffering is being inflicted and whether there is a reasonable alternative to the degree of the suffering. So if an animal is being blinded to test a deodorant or a perfume, something that the world could live without, then indeed that type of animal experimentation would be prohibited. If you're testing a cancer drug by inducing tumors in laboratory animals and then seeing if the drug works, that's a totally different story. Because one is engaged in experimentation for the purpose of saving potential life. We totally reject the notion that animals and people are equal. Animals can be exploited. The Chumash itself says that man was made to be master of the animal kingdom. But one has a responsibility not to engage in wanton, unnecessary cruelty. So as is often the case, Judaism veers between the extremes. It rejects the PETA notion that any use of animals for human welfare is immoral, but we also reject the notion of total exploitation. And rather, we simply have to look at
a significant benefit for a human being versus benefits that are more transient and inferior. Let me mention one more halakhic concept that at first glance does not appear to be relevant to the environment, but the Maharal tells us it is. The Torah has many laws that might be described as anti-mixing laws. You don't mix meat and milk. You don't mix wool and linen. You don't crossbreed different types of animals. You're not supposed to make mules by mating horses and donkeys, etc. You're not even supposed to graft different fruits. You're allowed to eat, for example, a fruit that is produced from two fruits, but you're not allowed to make it. Right? You don't create new species. Now, what this suggests, the Maharal says, is that God wants each species to be preserved in its uniqueness, in its individuality. When God made the world, the Pasuk says, V'yara Elokim es kol asher asah, God saw everything that He made. V'hine tov v'yod, it was good. And therefore, when you obliterate species, when you destroy their singularity, their identity, there is something intrinsically wrong with that. Because one is taking part of God's creation, and one is defacing it. You may recall years ago, the infamous snail darter, this little fish that nobody knew what it was for, and some major dam project was discontinued because it would endanger the little snail darter. Now, in a cost-benefit calculus, perhaps that would be justified to go ahead. But there is a real point in not destroying species. And there are many, you know, to this day, there are bird species and other species that are actually approaching extinction. And one needs to preserve the species. Because, you know, ecology is so fragile and so subtle that if you change any aspect of the system, you have no idea what the repercussions are in the interlocking system that Hashem created. You know, it's been well said that the reason why computers cannot predict weather very well is the weather can change. If an extra leaf falls off a tree in China, it generates a little tiny wind that's magnified till the whole world is changed, and there's no computer that can take account of every leaf in the world. And that is why we cannot predict the weather that far in advance. Remember the famous Medrash with David HaMelech? That David HaMelech asked Hashem, what's the use of spiders? Who needs spiders? And when he's running away from Shaul and he's hiding in a cave, and Shaul is going through cave by cave by cave, a spider wove a web. And when Shaul saw the web, he said, oh, there's nobody in there. And David then realized everything has a purpose. So there is a concept, the Maharal says, of not mixing is the preservation of the unique identity of every species. And that too is an obligation that we have towards the environment. So, Bekitzur, we've mentioned a number of halachic concepts. We've mentioned Baal Tashchit, the prohibition against wanton destruction. We've mentioned my interpersonal responsibilities, not to use my property in a way that injures the rights of others. We mentioned the special laws of city planning, the green belt around the Levite cities. We mentioned the special rules regarding the beautification of the land of Israel. We've talked about the prohibition against endangerment and the laws against imposing unnecessary pain on animals and the laws against mixing. So you take all of these different halachot, which are discrete bodies of law, having their own development and their own text, it's not all located in one place, and you overall can see that there indeed has to be a great sensitivity to the environment that we're surrounded by. But again, not so much because of a duty to the environment, but because of my duties to my fellow human beings. Now here I just want to briefly, and I'm almost finished here, just articulate in the realm of Agada, the spiritual and moral aspect, four different ideas which support the notion of our obligations to the environment. Number one, by recognizing and protecting the beauty of the world that we live in, that causes us to love and appreciate God through the marvels of His creation. If you look in Psalms, you see that David HaMelech says, when I look at the stars, when I look at the sky,
When I look at the complexity of your universe, my heart is filled with love for the wonders of your world. Maimonides writes that if one studies science, one comes to an appreciation of God by looking at the wonders of nature. So an appreciation of nature is something that generates hakarat hatov, gratitude and love within our hearts. Why do we make brachot? We make brachot before we eat, before we go to the bathroom, because we want to express our deep gratitude to God for the world that we live. And indeed, the Talmud Yerushalmi writes that a person will be held to account in the world to come for every permissible pleasure they could have indulged in that they did not. God is going to ask us, says Rav Shimshon Farvarsh, did you get a chance to look at the Alps? And if you say no, of course he was in Germany, he was much closer to him, but and if you will say no, God will say, why not? I put them there for you to enjoy and marvel at. So one who turns a blind eye to the beauties of flowers and grass and nature is turning a blind eye to the goodness of Hashem's creation and does not have appreciation for our Kadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, some say, there's a statement in Pirkei Avot that some say is anti-environmental, but you can interpret it the opposite way. It says in Pirkei Avot, if a person is walking in the streets and he stops his learning and he says, how beautiful is this tree? Pirkei Avot says, he deserves to die because he stopped his learning to admire the tree. So some say, oh, so you see, the Mishnah says, keep your nose in the book and don't look at the tree. But I saw an explanation from Dr. Abraham Twersky where he says, no, what the Mishnah means is he stops his learning and looks at the tree, meaning he doesn't regard looking at the tree as part of the spiritual growth. He separates his appreciation of nature from his learning of Torah. He does not regard nature as a conduit to appreciate God. That's the person that deserves to die. But the person who looks at the tree and from there has hakarat hatov to God, that is actually a very, very beautiful thing. That is a good thing. That's why I have a teacher in the Neri Yisrael Yeshiva who used to say that what is the halachic role of a vacation, right? Our vacation is justified. After all, you're supposed to study Torah, do mitzvot. What's the excuse to go away? So he said, the excuse to go away is only if it ties into your spiritual development of a Jew by appreciating the world that Hashem created. And that is why he said that the halachically proper vacation is roughing it in the woods and not going to man-made things. But again, I'm certainly not issuing a psak halacha on that particular issue. Okay, so that's one issue, that we love and appreciate God through our sense of wonder of the world. Issue number two, and this is actually a common ground with the high ecology, and that is, to some degree, although this is not a dominant theme, we have to have hakarat hatov to the earth itself. There is a concept in Judaism that you have gratitude even to the inanimate if it has served you well. Where do we see there's such a concept of gratitude to the inanimate? Well, we have two sources. One is the 10 plagues. If you remember, we just had Pesach. The first of the 10 plagues is that the Nile was smitten and turned into blood. Well, that plague was performed by Aaron. It was not performed by Moshe. Why didn't Moshe hit the water? So Rashi explains, since the Nile River had protected Moshe, you know, Moshe was put on the Nile, he should not do something bad to the river. He owed gratitude to the water, and therefore Aaron did it. As Chazal say, the well from which you drink, do not spit into. That's actually a statement in the Gemara. Another example of hakarat hatov to the inanimate is the halacha that Friday nights, or Shabbos morning as well, before we make kiddush, we cover up the bread. Why do we cover up the bread? So the reason that's given is because normally you begin a meal with hamotzi. But on Shabbat, you begin the meal with kiddush. The bread is going to feel embarrassed. And since bread does so much for us, right, unless you're on Atkins diet or something, but bread was considered to be the staff of life. We have a debt of gratitude to the bread
not to put it through some symbolic humiliation, so we cover it up.
So in that sense, you see an amazing thing. One has gratitude not only to conscious actors, one has gratitude even to the inanimate object.
That's why there were people, when they had to throw away a suit or whatever it is, they would actually, you know, they would clean it, and they would also, they would say that, this served me well, I'm grateful to it. The concept of hakarat hatov. So based on that, there is a notion, although I wouldn't say it's a dominant notion, that we owe a debt of gratitude to the water, to the earth itself, because they were the vehicles by which HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the bracha of being able to live. In this story, let me tell you a little story. There was a great rabbi who died around 2 years ago, Rabbi Avigdor Miller. He's a great, he was in his 90s, a great, great spiritual mentor. And his great theme in life was gratitude for the world. He was always talking about gratitude. In fact, he wrote an essay on meditation, on eating a banana, what you should think about when you eat a banana, and color and texture. He really goes into this sensitivity exercise. So the story is told, I read it after his death, his granddaughter once came to his house, and she found him in the kitchen with his head in the kitchen sink, submerged underwater. He was standing up, so she didn't know what it was, so she pulls him out of the water and says, "Zadie, what's going on? Are you okay?" He says, "I'm fine. I was about to get up from the water." He says, "I'm in the water." "I'll tell you why. You know, I was walking in the street, and every day I thank Hashem for the air and for the water. And I was walking with somebody, and somebody remarked," this was in Flatbush in Brooklyn, "somebody remarked, you know, the air quality just isn't so good today." And I felt very bad because that took away my sense of appreciation. So what I did was, I wanted to put my head in an environment where there was no air at all. So, just for a few seconds. So when I took out my head, I realized, you know, the air isn't so bad. You know, it's a way of enhancing appreciation. Okay. Again, this shouldn't be tried alone. Okay. Now, the third philosophical idea here, which underlies, of course, my responsibilities towards others, is that a Jew must have a responsibility not only for what is beneficial to them, but a Jew must have responsibilities for others. It can't be like King Louis of France, "Après moi, le déluge," you cannot say "after me, who cares what happens." But we have a responsibility not only towards our existing human beings, which we went through many halachot, but we have a responsibility towards future generations as well. It is very clear that the responsibility of a human being does not only exist towards people who are in this world today, but it also exists towards future generations. How do we know this? There's a story in the Talmud about a man who was planting a carob tree. And these carob trees take many, many years to grow. 70 years. And somebody approached the man and said, "Why are you doing something from which you will never benefit?" And his answer was, "My great-grandfather planted a tree, so I will benefit. Therefore, I must plant a tree, so my great-grandson will benefit." Obviously, therefore, when you look at environmental issues, you cannot just look at the impact on society on a given date, but one must consider the long-range aspect of one's actions because of their responsibility. The final philosophical idea that is relevant here is that if one inculcates within their personality attributes of waste, lack of consideration of others, and wanton cruelty to animals, one is not just hurting other people, but one is hurting oneself. One is developing a coarseness and an insensitivity that is going to adversely affect their own personality. In other words, the cruelty that we show to others destroys us from within. So I would suggest that the four philosophical ideas that underlie our respect for the environment, our respect towards the environment can lead us to love and appreciate God through the marvels of His creation. Number two, we have a debt of gratitude towards the earth itself, the earth and the water and the air. Number three, the notion of interpersonal responsibility does not only apply to the existing people in the world, but there is a debt towards future generations. And number four,
The callousness by which we live our lives and the selfishness ultimately destroys our moral character from within, making us less capable of being Avdei Hashem, faithful servants of God. Let me just end with two midrashim that illustrate these points. Midrash number one is, a man was once clearing out his field of stones, and he was throwing the stones in the streets, the public street. So a rabbi walked by and said, why are you removing stones from land that is not yours and putting the stones in land that is yours? Well, the man laughed and said, what are you talking about? It's exactly the opposite. Well, what happened is, the Talmud tells us, the man didn't pay his taxes, he lost his property, and he was forced to walk around in the street looking for a job, and he was tripping on the very stones that he put into the street. And then he realized, indeed, someone else bought the property at a tax sale. So all of the work that he did was benefiting that other person. The rabbi's words were prophetic. You remove the stones from land that was not yours, and you put it on land that is yours. Of course, that illustrates the English saying, what goes around comes around, or is it what comes around goes around, whichever way it goes. But the concept is that often the harm that we inflict on others does come back to harm us as well. And the final medrash, which is really, I think, the motto of the Jewish approach to the environment, is that when Adam HaRishon was put in the Garden of Eden, God commanded him, watch my garden, cultivate it, take care of it. For if you destroy it, there will be none after you that will be able to make it good. So thank you. I'll be happy to take questions.
Hi, Erev Tov. Good evening. We'll take questions in a minute. My job is to give some hakarat hatov, as our master teacher taught us. And in the meantime, while I'm doing hakarat hatov, your job is to think of questions. We will have a few. Rabbi Halpern will go around with a microphone so we can all hear and benefit. But first, again, hakarat hatov to Rabbi Reiterwitz, to Rabbi Halpern, to this Kihila Lomedet, this great learning community that does take advantage of the opportunity to hear and study Divrei Torah, which does actually purify our environment. I also must remind us that tonight, in another 15 minutes or so, at the Shkia, will be a special day, Yom HaZikaron L'Chalalei Tzahal U'Ma'archot Yisrael, a day of remembrance, albeit a Nidche day, where we must remember the gift that we were given, this special land, Eretz Chemda Tova, and we learn tonight a bit of how we have a stake in having that gift and pursuing that gift and keeping it as Eretz Chemda Tova, and also be a model to the rest of God's creation, because Israel, of course, is a part of an entire universe of creation. I was thinking about how to frame my thank you, and I was thinking of the Parsha. And what Rabbi Breidowitz does give to us is something that, in thinking of Tazria Mitzora, and thinking of what the word for environment is in modern Israeli Hebrew, which is Echut Hasviva. If you go to a university in Israel and you do environmental sciences, they talk about Echut Hasviva, which could also be translated as the quality surrounding us. And what is that quality? And when you look at one biblical negative example, which is, let's say in the Parsha, Lashon Hara, the ultimate air pollution of evil speaking, of the destructive force in the air that affects us, we see in the Torah that we even say it affects our exact environment. That one of the examples is Nega Bayit, a leprosy of even the walls of our very house, the closest environment that we live in and expect to escape the outside environment. And so, what I think I would like to thank Rabbi Breidowitz and wish as a as a bracha to all of us, is that as he taught us that the spiritual nature affects the physical nature, and that we here, by having us banish Lashon Hara with words of Lashon HaKodesh, and that includes, I hope, a pledge that we all learn Hebrew language, which we have at Ulpan and a few classes at the College of Jewish Studies, to improve our Lashon HaKodesh, would help, in fact, our both spiritual and physical environment. So thank you for helping us clean our environment from Lashon Hara and pollution, replacing it with Lashon HaKodesh, and changing Nega, Nun Gimel Ayin, to Oneg, which is the flip of the same words. So we're now ready to take some questions, and Rabbi Halpern will pass among us. I think there are two in the back.
Against unnecessary suffering and how real it is, and how the Halakha Ramban said. You gave the example of Shechitah and how Shechitah itself is not a cool method of slaughter. But what I want to focus on really is what you had alluded to before, and that is the treatment of the animal prior to Shechitah. And whether or not in actual Halakha, in actual Pesach, there are any examples of Kashrut authorities or Piskei Halakha where they say that the treatment of the animal makes it tereis, makes it not eatable.
Okay, let me just differentiate. It's a very good question. The way the halachic system works would be the following. An animal that was mistreated in the process of its slaughter would not be called non-kosher. Meaning you don't use the laws of kashrut, as some would do, to address some other concerns other than kashrut. So we do not believe per se in the notion of eco-kosher, in the sense that the ecology kosher. So the animal doesn't become treif in that sense. Nevertheless, the halakhic authorities have decried and criticized practices that are inhumane. They have not, as far as I've seen, called for a boycott. They have not done that, and I'm not in a position to call for a boycott, but certainly on the individual level, I do respect the moral scruples of a person who would not eat meat because of the mistreatment of animals. I think that is a halakhically legitimate response, which it would not be if you condemn the institution of shechita itself. But as I say, we don't use the laws of kashrut to address that particular concern.
Okay, I'm Gary Spolnick. I've been an environmental activist for several years now, and I'm glad to hear that a lot of the reasons why I'm an environmental activist are echoed in kind of the things that you have said. But I also studied a lot of, or I've looked in Jewish texts to find some background on what Judaism has to say on it, and I appreciate all the things you said tonight. The issue I specifically global warming, which most Americans don't really understand a lot about, and I can't really relate to, because global warming is something that's going to impact us far down the future, our children and grandchildren. But from a Jewish perspective, we certainly understand we have an obligation to all generations. Having said all that, as my preamble, sorry. I heard a lot of great things tonight about the environment, but yet I do not hear specific halakhot on very practical issues which affect global warming, air pollution, water pollution. Why is the Orthodox community not making halakhic determinations on whether it's okay to own an SUV if you don't need one, whether it's okay to use coal-fired power plants if you don't have to use that, and things of that sort? And I'm going to wrap it up.
Yeah.
And recycling. Here's a very specific question. Yeah. Recycling is the law in Montgomery County for businesses.
Yeah.
And the question is, why do no kosher restaurants recycle?
I can't speak to the facts that you're alleging, because I honestly don't know. But I would say this.
What issues the Orthodox community gets involved in and what they don't is a very, very tricky issue. And that is, sometimes on general issues of major social concern, very important social concern, there is a concept of letting others carry the ball simply because numerically the Orthodox community is relatively small and it is concerned with issues that nobody else is concerned with. So sometimes it is an issue of limited resources in prioritization of needs. Now, I'm not saying that the balance is always struck correctly, and your issues are absolutely very, very important, but I wouldn't chalk it up to indifference. I would think it's simply a question of limited resources to pursue a limited agenda. Now, if the kosher restaurants don't recycle, I would just urge them to do so. I'm honestly not aware of that particular issue.
Thank you. Please remember, time is a limited resource, so limit your question to 1 minute. Thank you.
My name is Yvonne Marzik, and I run an organization, a new organization called Company Sharing, which is dedicated to educating the Orthodox community about environmental issues from an Orthodox perspective. And I want to thank you so much for speaking. I think this is great. I'm so glad to hear you laying out these issues.
Are you located here in the Washington area?
We're based in the Washington area, but we actually have members all around the world.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah. So, and the question I want to ask you is actually about risk assessment, and about at what point do you think it becomes worthy to start exploring kinds of different issues, and if there are sort of air pollution or water pollution kinds of issues, at what point do those kinds of protection become halakhically imperative for us? So at what point can we begin to explore whether those sorts of things are halakhically imperative in terms of risk assessment, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100? Yeah. Is there any sense to that kind of thing? And in terms of the sense of what's causing things, how we know what we've reached that point?
Yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately, risk assessment is probably the single most complicated area in the entire environmental fields, even from a secular standpoint. It's equally complicated in the halakhic sense, simply because the halakhic system, when it's not part of a state, does not have the resources to accurately quantify or predict various risk assessments, and consequently, we really depend on the government or industry or public policy institutes to do that type of legwork. I mean, the halakhic system doesn't have that type of resources. But if you're asking in an abstract, when would a risk be considered to be significant enough that it would preclude a certain course of action? The answer in the abstract would be a utilitarian calculus. Are more people going to benefit than the people that are going to be negatively affected? Now, that doesn't tell you how do you make that calculus, and that I don't know, but it would be a pure utilitarian calculus in that sense. Yes, sir.
Hi.
Oh, I don't know. Are you someone picking the... I'm sorry. Pardon me.
I remember that as a child, when my parents would give me a gift or a toy, they had an expectation that I would care for it. In Bereshit, when we're given dominion over the animals and the rest of the world, is there a similar expectation that we're halakha?
Well, you know, you're 100% correct. That's why I indicated in the beginning of my remarks that the authorization of domination and control is coupled with the command to preserve and to serve. So indeed, God is saying, like the toy, I've given you this earth. It's your job to keep it, use it wisely, and do not destroy it, and preserve it for future generations. That's really exactly, you know, you've encapsulated exactly the point. The Christian community uses this phrase, but you know, it's a perfectly appropriate Jewish phrase, and that's responsible stewardship. And that is, we are indeed, God gave us mastery over the world, but we have to use it in a responsible, non-destructive manner.
How do the laws of mixing food?
Yeah, that's actually a very, very excellent question. People were discussing, some genetic material from pigs was going to be inserted in tomatoes. So one question was raised, well, is that going to be a non-kosher tomato, a pig tomato, you know, and the like.
It is a very, very good question. The halacha seems to say, since the mixing occurs at a sub-visual level, a visual that's not apparent to the naked eye, that type of intermingling is not within the proscription of interbreeding. But it is a difficult question. Also, one other thing. The way genetic engineering commonly works is a replica, a chemical replica. You're not actually taking something from the other animal. It's kind of a Xerox or copy of the DNA, and therefore it's one step removed from the actual thing. Okay, I think Rabbi Halpern is picking people. Yeah.
My name is Beth. My mother calls me Eco Science. I have a question whether there's a conflict between when you decide something is too much money. For example, New York City, Bloomberg, he said that we couldn't recycle anymore because it wasn't cost effective. However, for long term, you know, when we talk about this happening for a long term, like in, later on, we're not having any landfills anymore if we don't recycle. So you have a direct conflict between time, next generation, and money. How do you reconcile that conflict?
Very, 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 very good question. I think that it is short-sighted to freeze frame the earth and say, right now something is too expensive. I think that you have to look. I think the medrash that I cited about planting the tree for the future generations say that we have to look at the long-term consequences of everything that we do. The only problem is, let's take a case like Bloomberg, the only problem is that if you elevate that need and make it a budget priority, what are you going to be cutting out? Are you going to be closing hospitals? Are you going to be denying medical care? You know, it's very easy, in a sense, to be in favor of what we should spend money on, but it then results in the tremendously difficult issue of where are you going to get it and where are you going to take it out from. And I think that's part of the dilemma. I mean, politics, you know, is a very, very difficult game, and the halakhic system does not obviate the need to engage in those political calculations. In other words, halakha does not, you know, halakha does say society has to make those decisions.
There's a resurgence in the use of herbs in the community of the world, really, now to take care of disease. And I see in the Torah that God is the source of these herbs, and we lived in the last probably 50 or 75 years with an emphasis on the use of drugs, which are generally man-made. They are certainly foreign substances to the human body, and they provide side effects and problems that are, in an individual way, a total pollution of the human body compared to what God has produced as herbs. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there was any thoughts about that.
Well, you know, you're raising the general question of how does Judaism view alternative medicine, alternative healing, the use of natural methods of healing. I think you're 100% correct that God created a world in which herbs and plants and fruits and all sorts of things are conducive to healing. There's even a phrase in the book of Yechezkel called Olim L'Trufa, which means leaves which give healing. The problem is, however, that sometimes we have limitations as to our knowledge. For example, the healing substances in herbs, if they're taken in the wrong quantities, etc., or in combination with other things, can have dangerous interactions. So I wouldn't say that there's a problem with the herbs, but there's a problem in our particular knowledge. Perhaps we've lost much wisdom that was known maybe hundreds of years ago. We always look at science as progressing. I would suspect that with respect to certain types of arts, we have regressed. So, as I say, so right now there is a certain margin of danger in over-reliance on some of the natural herbs, simply because of our ignorance. But that may change with the passage of time. Okay, let me help you.
I just want to make one announcement before we continue that there's going to be a moderate meeting in the next room when we finish the question.
You made two references to first to farming, and obviously that was very relevant at one point in Israel, the dependence on climate and rain, etc. We know today that technology has changed many of these dependencies drastically. The other is with mixing. Again, mixing, you know, you do grafting, you create hybrids, and I'm sure that the Alaha has been updating itself to take into account these technological changes.
Yeah. Well, the truth of the matter is, surprisingly enough, you would be surprised that all the advances of technology have not really totally freed the farmer from the vagaries of nature. I mean, to some degree, things are, you can have a greenhouse and everything else, but the wheat and the corn, still needs that rain and that sun. In terms of the hundreds, once again, the halakha has not been updated. Now again, we are allowed to benefit from the product, but a religious Jew is not supposed to manufacture the hybrids, and that still is on the books, even today. Of course, let me just explain something. A hybrid only refers to two different species. If you take, for example, two types of rice and you put them together, that's permitted, wheat and the like.
It takes about 4 pounds of grain to raise 1 pound of cattle to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Is this fact in and of itself a good reason halakhically to become a vegetarian?
Well, it is very, very true that a tremendous amount of grain, as you say, 4 pounds, I've even heard 7 to 8 pounds, depending on how it works. And of course, I think the Torah envisioned that cattle would eat grass. Maybe that's another argument, besides the health benefit. That's another argument why we should go for grass-fed cattle instead of grain-fed cattle. The problem is this, though. There is enough food in the world to sustain a population even much larger than is presently the case. The issue is not the quantity of food in the world. The issue is the distribution or the absence of distribution. So I don't think we've reached a type of equilibrium where that type of thing would be a calculus, but theoretically that could be the case. In other words, if you lived in a world where there was a shortage of food for existing populations because of a shortage of food, then at some point we should become vegetarian. But I don't think empirically that is truly the situation that we're in. The problem of the world is distribution. It is not lack of food, per se.
Thank you so much for talking to me and bringing awareness, because truly by awareness we make better choices and we may stand idly by nonetheless. My question is, and it has to be followed by a few points, but the question is, how can Judaism support and allow eating of animal products when we consider that we are supposed to, that our beautiful religion teaches us to feed the hungry, and there's no question about it that it takes massive quantities of food to make little bits of meat. There's no question about that it takes huge quantities of water, pesticides, soil, and it is ruining the environment, rainforests are destroyed. There's no question about it. There's no question that animals suffer their entire lives, not just when they go to slaughter, and the fact that they move at such huge, fast rate when they're being slaughtered, so that perhaps it's not true the fact that it's painless slaughter. How can it be that our religion permits eating of animals when we espouse peace, and in fact, blood is shed to our knees, and in fact, we ingest that bad karma? How can it be when Gandhi said a nation's morals can be measured in how it treats its animals? And there's more, but I don't want to take up too much time, but it is important. How can we, in the way our society is today, the fact that we're many, many people now, not like 500,000 years ago when we had fewer people and we could raise an animal and we wouldn't destroy our environment, but now that it is the way it is, how can we continue to support that as Jewish people?
Well, listen, I respect much of what you say, and I in fact agree with much of what you say, although not everything that you say. One point of clarification. You had mentioned the rainforests. How do you connect it to animal slaughter?
Rainforests are torn down all the time so that grass can grow, okay. So that animals can...
All right, I understand. Let me point out this. Judaism condemns the cruelty to the animals. Judaism condemns the penning up of the animals. Judaism condemns
any type of suffering of the animals. And if one, as I indicated, if one is a vegetarian because one is protesting or one does not, one wants to disassociate from that cruel behavior, I respect that and I believe it's halakhically legitimate. And it may be an appropriate response. On the other hand, I'll just reassert my point that the Torah does legitimate the painless killing of an animal for human consumption. Now, you may not accept this, but there is actually a mystical idea that the animal soul gets elevated by being incorporated into a human soul that is obeying the words of God.
There is even, but that's too small compared to the thing that I've been talking about. If we look at logic and sensibility,
let me just say that your earlier point about feeding the hungry goes back to what I said, that it is true that it takes many pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef, and it takes a lot of gallons of water, etc. But as I indicated, the real problem in the world, the shortages that exist in the world, I would suggest do not arise from the consumption of meat, but they arise from the inadequacies of a distribution system.
It arises from greed.
Well, that's fine. What I'm saying is I wouldn't lay the blame on meat, necessarily. I think that without that greed, we would be able to get our food out from Ethiopia and Sudan and all those other countries. Greed is a problem. Of course it's a problem. But the meat is not the source of all evil in that respect.
I think there's a gentleman there who has his hand up and the questions will complete the question.
Kevin, I'd just like to raise a point that I put out. It's a question that would probably take a seminar in itself for you to answer, but sort of a flip side to this environmental issues is that it's interesting to note, I'd like you to comment on what you think, this is sort of a social, political question, that during Nazi Germany, it's interesting you mentioned that Hitler was a vegetarian. It's also interesting to note that euthanasia, which is Peter Singer's idea, was a major component of Nazism, but also that really the first anti-smoking campaign, educational campaign, actually started in Germany also. And they were very much ahead of the curve on this. So I think it's sort of a flip side to this sort of perfervid type of environmentalism where you can see that if you elevate these ideas, that maybe it has other consequences that we haven't considered.
Yeah, I think that this really confirms the point that was made by Ralph Cook well before the Holocaust, in which there's kind of a natural progression of moral sensitivities. And when you jump and you try to focus on things that are a little beyond where you are, you will tend to destroy more fundamental values. But Cook suggests vegetarianism is the appropriate move when we've perfected our interpersonal relationships. But if you jump ahead of the gun, we'll destroy those relationships.
Okay. There will be one more. The next question is, gentlemen, and after this, those men who like to join our brother, it's in Mali, to the big English. And we want to thank our brothers again for.
How do you reconcile between Tzar Bane Chaim and Korbanot?
Well, excellent question. Korbanot, of course, are sacrifices, and that raises a whole bunch of questions. First, let me just remind people, I'm sure you've heard this before, of the fundamental debate between the Rambam, Maimonides, and Ramban, where Rambam actually says God does not intrinsically desire Korbanot. But since the Jewish people were engaged in idolatrous rituals, even involving human sacrifice, God wanted to wean us away from idolatry. Cold turkey would have been, forgive the pun, would have been too hard, and therefore Korbanot. So according to that, Korbanot was supposed to be a temporary concession. Now that's Maimonides' position. Nachmanides strongly disagrees, and Nachmanides does say Korbanot are reyach nicholah, they're in pleasant fragrance for God. Now once again, the Korbanot, the only thing that is done to the behema is shechita. And if you go with the idea that shechita is not intrinsically a tzar to the animal, so, you know, you certainly don't mistreat the animals. In fact, unlike commercial packing houses and the like, animals were not stored in any long-term way. And bring in the animal, you slaughter it, and shechita is regarded as so in a sense that it would not be the
okay, thank you very much, Rob Brother. It's a stay up night, and we're going to have to do it again.